Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, our Friday newscap panelists will be analyzing the week's top stories, and the Phoenix Mercury begin a new season tomorrow with a whole lot of new players. But first, the state legislature continues its break next week. GOP leaders said they would use their time out of session to work on a new state budget ahead of the end of the fiscal year on June 30th. There are other issues they need to address as well, including a renewal of Proposition 123, which voters approved nearly a decade ago and is set to expire. The measure takes money out of the state land trust and gives it to schools. Republican lawmakers and Governor Katie Hobbs are not in agreement over what a new version should look like, including a proposal from the GOP to ask voters to add protections for ESAs, basically school vouchers, to the state constitution. Governor Hobbs came by the studio yesterday afternoon to talk about some of these issues, and we started our conversation with Prop 123 and where she and lawmakers are on coming up with a plan to renew it.
I put forward a plan that pays our teachers more and invests in public education, and unfortunately, the Republicans in the legislature have chosen to politicize public education. They're trying to bog this proposal down with protections for constitutional protection for the unaccountable ESAs. So, you know, we're still pushing for a plan that pays teachers more and doesn't constitutionally protect this program. And at the end of the day, voters will be able to have the final say, but we're not even close to getting something through the legislature at this point. And unfortunately, with their politicizing, what that's going to do, this funding expires this year. Mm-hmm. And because they're politicizing it, they're going to have to kick it to the November 2026 ballot instead of having me sign legislation that would allow for an election this year. And so we're kicking it down the road, and we need solutions now.
Are there any areas of agreement? Like, I know in the past, you and the Republicans have had different percentages that you'd like to take out of the trust and where that money would go. Are there areas of agreement here?
Yeah, well, so far, we haven't seen the plan that the Senate Republicans are trying to push through. So I don't know the answer to that. I think the amount from the trust was an issue that we were concerned about when we first passed this in 2016. However, the 10 years it's been in place have shown that the trust can sustain it, and our projections show we could even take more. But really want to get a plan that increases teacher pay, which is something we know needs to happen across the state. And I don't even know if there's agreement from the Republicans on that.
If the Republican plan that they send to the ballot, because of course it wouldn't go to you, it would just go right to the ballot. Mm-hmm. If that were to include constitutional protections for ESAs, does that mean that you don't support the plan?
That is absolutely a non-starter for me. What I've said from the get-go is that I want to see a bipartisan plan. And certainly there aren't any Democrats in the legislature that would get on board with that. And, you know, there's bipartisan support among Arizonans for the ESA program. But I don't think there's bipartisan support for the current iteration of that program that has no accountability and no protection for taxpayers. It's a $1 billion boondoggle, and certainly don't want to provide constitutional protection for that.
So what would that mean? Again, assuming that that is the plan that goes to the ballot, would you be in favor of a separate plan that didn't include the vouchers? Like, what would that mean?
Yeah, no, I think if that's what they try to put forward, it's going to face challenges from the get-go. I don't want to get too in the weeds, but constitutional amendments that go to the ballot have to focus on a single subject. And so it's ripe for challenge before it even gets to the ballot. And I'm sure that's something that they might be considering, but I would anticipate multiple lawsuits filed if that's what they end up putting forward.
All right. One other thing I know you guys are working on is the state budget, obviously. Mm-hmm. That was the point of legislative leadership deciding to take a couple week break to focus on that. I know you're not a huge fan of that approach. Are you making any progress? Are you getting closer to passing a, or coming up with an agreement on a budget?
Look, I put out my budget in January. It lowers costs. It works to protect the border. It gives police officers a raise. It addresses veterans' homelessness. We have yet to see what the Republican priorities are. And before we can negotiate a budget, they need to show us what their priorities are. And we're not even there yet.
Have there not been meetings between at least your office, your staff, and legislative staff?
On the budget, no.
Really? So it sounds like you're not anywhere close to having an agreement, what, like 5 weeks ahead of the end of the fiscal year?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. Another issue that I know has been ongoing throughout the session is a bill dealing with Chase Field downtown. Mm-hmm. There's been a few different iterations of this. Mm-hmm. Is that one that there might be some agreement? Because it seems like there's been some bipartisan agreement on that, although the city of Phoenix, the county, mm-hmm. is not necessarily on board with what's been at the legislature so far. What's the status of that?
So I want to get a bill that will help keep the Diamondbacks in Phoenix, that will create jobs, and that protects taxpayer dollars. I think we're headed in the right direction. I think we're close. I have brought together business leaders, the elected leaders of the county and the city, along with legislators, to hammer out a plan that works. It is important to keep the Diamondbacks in Phoenix. It will hurt small businesses and Arizonans if they're not. But we have to make sure we're putting in reasonable guardrails for taxpayer dollars. And I feel like we're very close. We're having ongoing discussions. And I'm optimistic about getting that done.
So is there a way to make sure that there is some amount of money raised from the state? Because that seems to be what the Diamondbacks want to put into this fund while not taking a ton of money from the county and the city of Phoenix and even the state.
So the idea of the stadium district is that the revenue generated by the sales at Chase Field are what are funding the needs. I'm not in support of a plan that takes general fund dollars, and I don't think that's on the table right now. But I don't want to get into the specific details because those are changing.
Sure.
But yeah, general fund dollars are off the table here.
No, but if the right now the sales taxes mm-hmm. go to the state, the county, and the cities. Mm-hmm. And I know that's one of the issues that Mayor Kay Gallego has had, that
right.
some of the county supervisors have had, is that if the plan, as it has been discussed in the legislature, mm-hmm. were to go into effect, they would lose out on all of that tax revenue that they currently get from sales at Chase Field. So it seems like there's a balance to be struck.
Yeah,
there.
And that's part of the ongoing discussion. I think we're looking at what kind of cap makes sense. The fact of the matter is, if the Diamondbacks are not playing at Chase Field, there is no revenue generated at all. So the city and the county are losing that revenue, period. And so we want to find a plan that strikes the right balance and look at a reasonable cap there on in terms of how much of the revenue goes back into the stadium.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you, obviously none of us can see the future, but there's been a lot of discussion about how you are very, very close to your veto record set from 2023. You're, I think, five short. Given what is still left to go in the legislature, do you think that record's going to stand after the end of May or June?
Well, I don't know what kind of bills, you know, this legislature has sent me bills that I've already vetoed this session, and they've sent them again to me this session. And there's always the chance to resurrect something that seems like it's dead. And I don't know what's sitting in that pile. But, you know, the things that we've just touched on, those are really the big outstanding issues. And so, you know, hopefully the legislature gets to work on solving these tough challenges instead of, you know, stuff that infringes on Arizona's freedoms and doesn't move us forward on tackling our tough problems.
Do you make anything of the number of bills you veto or have to veto, given that the first year it was pretty high, mm-hmm. second year was lower, now the third year we're back up high again?
You know, I think that a lot of it is political gamesmanship. I've been very clear that I'm not going to sign legislation that takes away Arizonans' freedoms and is not focused on solving tough problems. I get a lot of legislation that is solutions in search of a problem. And I have asked the legislature to work with me on the Arizona Promise, bringing about freedom and security and opportunity for Arizonans. And I'm continue to be ready to do that.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs. Governor Hobbs, thank you.
Thank you.
And now it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We need to secure the southern border, reform our asylum system, expand legal pathways to citizenship, protect dreamers, and tackle the reasons why people leave their homes in the first place.
I always knew that Preston was destined to do great things and pave the way as an upstanding young man. Of course, I never imagined that his impact would come through his death. But even in this unimaginable tragedy, he continues to inspire change.
The fact that this is a missing child, just the fact that they're a child and that they're missing, we should be sounding the alarm.
That's where we lose the whole shooting match of 650,000 covered lives. That's how we lose it, by losing the provider tax and then having the state legislature say, we ain't down for this.
But what Roger Stone said is really, really dangerous. My wife, Gabby Giffords, was nearly assassinated. She was shot in the head. Political violence is a real thing, and they're trying to make it worse.
And with me to talk about another proposal to deal with immigration on the federal level, another entrant into a congressional race and more, are Matthew Benson of Veritas. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
And Matt Gronsky of Matters of State Strategies. Matt, good morning to
you. Good morning.
We're going to have to use some last names here to guess with the same name. So, Matt Gronsky, we'll start with you. This kind of feels like deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra once said. Senator Ruben Gallego pitching a plan that he hopes will be bipartisan on border security and immigration reform. I'm curious what you make of this compared with past efforts by senators like Kyrsten Sinema, Jeff Flake, John McCain from Arizona.
Sure. No, I mean, I think it's a great effort, a good idea on his part. It shows leadership. For the longest time, Republicans always talk about how immigration is the number one issue. We have to solve that. And yes, while, you know, crossings are down and the president has gotten a lot of credit for that, I think the senator is looking for long-term solutions. And if he doesn't get bipartisan support on this, he can always point back and say, look, I was the one who tried. Why aren't you guys trying now?
Matt Benson, do you think he will get bipartisan support on this?
I'm skeptical. And in part because we've kind of seen this play out. We've seen how this movie ends multiple times and brought by folks from both parties. But here's the challenge right now. You know, traditionally the idea was Republicans thought, well, this has to be done by Congress. It has to be somehow comprehensive. There has to be some give and take. You know, border security here, pathway for dreamers over there.
Mm-hmm.
I think President Trump has shown that actually, no, you don't. And Trump has just chosen to go about this administratively, focus purely on border security. He has dropped the crossings to a virtual trickle. And for conservatives and Republicans writ large, I'm not sure what the motivation is now that they have to get behind a comprehensive approach like what Gallego has put forward.
So your thinking is that conservatives and Republicans are happy with what they have and don't feel the need to give on stuff they don't necessarily want?
100%. I mean, from their perspective, the status quo works. There's virtually no crossings at this point, and they don't have to give up anything in terms of, you know, anything that could be considered amnesty among base voters on the right.
So, Matt Gronsky, is that how big of a challenge do you think that might be to Senator Gallego and his colleagues who might want to do this?
It's a clear challenge. I think they anticipate that challenge. I think, again, this is a short-term period of time where these crossings are low. But the reality is, if you zoom out, Republicans, since it feels like the beginning of time, they want this as a wedge issue. It's a useful issue when we get to midterms or presidential election years. So if the onus is not on them to have to solve it and they can just hide behind the president and his executive authority, that's a win for them. So I think the senator and his team recognize that. But again, this comes back to showing leadership, which is something he'll be able to point back to when this issue heats up again.
And I would only suggest that I think both parties have demonstrated over the last 40 years they're happy to use this as a wedge issue.
And it certainly has been a wedge issue that both parties have used. I'm curious, though, Matt, when you talk about leadership, is this also something he might point back to for, I don't know, maybe a run for another office? And there's been a lot of talk. He held a town hall in suburban Philadelphia not that long ago. There's been a lot of talk that he might have aspirations higher than the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think he's wrong to keep that door open. The nature of where we are in the world right now, we don't know what the next week is going to look like in the political climate, let alone where we're going to be in 2028. So I think it's wise for him and leaders like him to, you know, keep that door open and identify opportunities and have stuff to point back to if that opportunity presents itself.
Do you think he runs?
We'll see. I don't know. I don't have my crystal ball plugged in, but he wouldn't be a bad pick.
Matt Benson, do you think this is in some way, introducing this bill, having the rally in Bucks County, Pennsylvania? Like, is this done with an eye maybe on something else other than the Senate?
Potentially. I mean, I think it's done with an eye toward making himself a player on the national stage. And I think he's pretty quickly doing that. And he certainly has the biography to make for an interesting candidate on a national level. Whether this leads to a presidential run or not, I think I agree with Matt G. It's much too early to say.
All right, fair enough. We'll just focus on the 2026 election a year ahead as opposed to the 2028 election 3 years
Sounds
ahead.
Good.
So, Matt Grodsky, let me ask you about the first congressional district. We had one candidate, Marlene Galan Woods, who ran last year, who's planning to run again next year against incumbent Republican David Schweikert. We now have a second candidate. This is the candidate who actually won the primary, Amish Shah, former state representative, who has announced he's getting back in. We should say you worked with another of the candidates last year who was in the race, who is not, we don't think, getting in the race again this time. But like, so now we have two candidates who already did this. Like, is this sort of rerun good for Democrats in this district?
We're going to need a longer show for this one. But there are two candidates in the race that ran last time. There are actually additional candidates currently in the race that are just less well known. The individual I worked with last time will not be running this time around. I think like the rest of us, we're all recovering from that race. Here's the problem. Unless they find a way to make this a two-way race between Marlene Woods and Amish Shah, I think, given what history has shown us, Shah comes out on top, just given the nature of the district and the name ID he's established, having worked in LD5 and done such a good job knocking doors. Now, the problem is I'm not sure if that translates into a general election win, given how much voter registration has dropped off for Democrats since the 22 election. Between 2022 and 2024, Republicans added 11,000 voters. We added a little over 2,500. So unless we solve that issue, it's going to be really hard to beat Schweikert, even if it is a big wave year.
Well, and Matt Benson, like, Democrats have been talking about knocking off David Schweikert in congressional races seemingly since he first got in, however long ago that was. He's a tough out.
He's a survivor. Democrats on many occasions and through many cycles have thought, this is the year. This is the year we got him. And it hasn't panned out that way. Typically you'd think a midterm year like what we have coming up should be in the Democrats' favor. But, the voter registration in that district is going to be increasingly challenging for the Democrats. And I would hesitate to take my money off of Schweikert.
Is this the kind of race where, I mean, and we see this not just in Arizona, but around the country where candidates in one cycle lose and then come back and try to run again. And sometimes they win and sometimes they don't. Is this the kind of race that having familiarity, let's say that either Woods or Shah are the winners of the primary and face Schweikert again, like is having somebody who's done it before helpful or is it time maybe for a reset?
I mean, sometimes it helps in terms of the name ID. There's some, some residual from the last cycle. But also I feel like voters tend to feel like, this is a sequel, and the sequel's never as good as the original. And so I don't believe either of those two candidates can knock him out.
Matt Grodsky, do you think this is a good case for a rerun, or would it be better maybe if somebody new was
I think there's an argument to be made on familiarity, but the problem is the dynamics have not changed. Registration has not dramatically swung in Democrats' favor. The primary itself, we haven't gotten smart enough to narrow the field enough where, it can be a horse race or just clear it for one candidate so you can spend a year and a half building resources for someone in the general election. So, again, I'm highly skeptical about the results of how this turns out with whoever the nominee is once we get to the general because we haven't gotten our act together as a party.
All right, Matt, let me stick with you. We just heard from Governor Katie Hobbs, who was here yesterday. She said that there really haven't been any budget talks and we're, 5-6 weeks away from the end of the fiscal year.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't seem great.
It doesn't seem great. It's not surprising given the way that the Republicans in the legislature have comported themselves. They've decided that they're going to go on vacation instead of, having budget conversations. And then there's the whole Prop 123 thing, which is, expiring next month. So heard her interview, share her frustration, unfortunately. This goes back to how Democrats need to message and make the case for why we need to take control of the ledge finally instead of having this divided government situation.
So, Matt Benson, let me ask you, because you worked in a governor's office, you worked for Governor Brewer, and there were some she, you know, the budget process was not always super smooth, even though she had a Republican legislature that she was working with. Is this the kind of thing, like, is it surprising to you that here on May 16th that there really haven't been substantive talks between the governor's office and the legislature?
No, nothing surprises me at this point in terms of the state capitol. And governors complaining about the legislature going on break, is that's a tale as old as time. I mean,
yeah.
Governor Brewer did it, Napolitano did it, Ducey did it, now Katie Hobbs is doing it. So I think typically the dynamic is that, you know, time is not on the legislature's side. You know, the governor is going to be on the ninth floor all summer anyway. Mm-hmm. And so the legislature would prefer to finish up, get back to their jobs, especially as it gets hotter and all of that. So I look. They're gonna get together. They're gonna hash this out. They will figure it out. I am confident between now and the end of the year, or the end of the fiscal year, yeah. which is the end of June. And ultimately, you know, the fact that it's mid-May and they haven't done it yet, I don't think politically matters.
Does it? I mean, obviously, in politics, you know, deadlines and with all aspects of life, many aspects of life, deadlines sort of spur action. Is this the kind of thing, given the dynamics between a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature and some of the uncertainty with, you know, what kind of federal money is going to be around, what the impact of the tariffs might be on the economy? Is this the kind of thing where we might really be down to the wire at middle to end of June before we have a deal?
I mean, I always expect that they would get a deal in mid-June. I will tell you, and you brought up tariffs and the economy, as the new economic data comes in month by month, I think that's going to make it a more challenging financial picture for the state, and the legislature may end up wishing and regretting that they didn't get a budget done sooner, because a lot of that money that I think they're planning to have may not be there.
Yeah, Matt Grotsky, I mean, that seems like it would be a pretty significant issue.
Yes, I'm nodding aggressively back here. I couldn't agree more, and I do think that they will regret it just given the dynamics of the economy. And I do think that that plays to the governor's advantage. The other thing I would add is you've got to message this stuff, right? So again, pulling it back to the political lens, what parties should do, what consultants should do, what operatives should do, is they've got to tell that story because, to Matt's point, you know, this has happened before. People go on vacation, there's budget drama, you know, nothing new to the average voter. You got to talk about the ramifications and get that message out.
So let's go to some bills that the governor dealt with this past week. And Matt Grotsky, I'm going to start with you on a bill that the governor vetoed, probably not super surprising, that would have required hospitals that accept Access, which is Arizona's Medicaid program, to ask patients about their immigration status. Now, the sponsor of the bill said this is not about denying care. It's really just about data collection. We need to know how many people who are not here legally hospitals are treating so we can figure out how to pay for it and just have that information. It's not a surprise, right, that the governor vetoed this?
It's not a surprise. You know, it's a lot of nice words in the description of it from the legislature's perspective. But let's be real. And I agree with the interview that the governor gave. This is another example of them playing political games, right, and them trying to make hay out of stuff she vetoes so that they can try to make her look bad. There's no reason for stuff like this. You know, they don't – in the hospital, you shouldn't be doing anything else than providing care. And I think the majority of Arizonans understand that. But again, it comes down to messaging that and making that case clear.
Matt Benson, do you consider this bill a political game?
Well, I don't know what – a lot of bills that the legislature maybe – considered political, like shocking news, right? There's politics going on in here. What? Let's start with this. Arizona's Medicaid program Access does not cover non-citizens. Okay. Now, in some states, Medicaid does. In Arizona, it does not. And so I think we just kind of start with that. And I agree with other Matt that hospitals, their focus needs to always be providing care to the people that come through that door and need it urgently, and everything else is secondary.
Well, and I think, Matt Benson, to your point, yes, Medicaid does not cover people who are not here legally. However, hospitals do have to treat anybody who comes through their door, whether they have insurance or not, whether they're citizens or legal residents or not. I wonder, like, is there a way, would it be helpful maybe to have this kind of information? Not sure what would be done with it, you know, if it could be anonymized some way so that, you know, you didn't have ICE agents showing up at hospitals to arrest people. Like, would it be helpful to have for the state to have a sense of how many people who are undocumented hospitals are treating here?
I would say what's unhelpful is if somebody is sick or injured, let's say it's a family that's not here legally and their child is sick and they're needing to go to the hospital, but they're contemplating whether that is going to result in them getting onto a federal list or being deported or something of that sort. I think that is unhelpful. And, you know, contrary to, I think, what we consider our hospitals should be their priorities. And so I think we want to avoid people not going to the hospital in emergency situations because they think that they're going to show up on a federal list.
All right. Matt Gronsky, let's move to another bill. This one is called Preston's Law, of course, after Preston Lord, the teenager who was killed in an attack by the group known as the Gilbert Goons. This bill increases penalties for group attacks. It seems like this was kind of one of those that's kind of a no-brainer to sign.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, people have been reading up on this for well over a year now. People wanted to see some action. So I think, again, the majority of Arizonans are going to be glad to see legislation passed. And hopefully it brings some comfort to the family that has had to deal with that for this long.
And this seems like one of those instances where I don't remember the vote totals, but it seemed like this was one that, you know, the governor was in favor of. Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell, Republican, was in favor of. Yep. A lot of members of both parties were in favor of this.
Yeah, this is one of those where, you know, if there's some people that don't like it, that's bizarre. You know, that things like that have happened, obviously, in the past. But I think this is one that should have been a shoo-in from the get-go.
And Matt Benson, with the caveat that none of the three of us are in law enforcement, this seems like it would be helpful for law enforcement and prosecutors to try to deter this kind of crime.
Yeah, throw the book at him. I mean, as the father of a soon-to-be teenage boy, we're seeing this sort of swarm-style violence all over the valley, and it doesn't really matter what neighborhood. It's going on everywhere, and it needs to stop. And so, the way you stop this kind of thing is by really hitting hard from a legal standpoint.
Okay, another bill. The governor had a lot of bills to deal with this week. Another one, Matt Benson, that she vetoed would have required hotels and motels to post signs if they are also housing people who do not have homes there. This is something that some cities are doing to try to get people off the streets and into a place with air conditioning in the summer and that sort of thing. The governor vetoed this. A lot of supporters said, look, if you're going to a hotel and you're paying to be there, you should know if there are people there who are not paying to be there. Is this one that surprised you that she vetoed?
No, it doesn't surprise me. I think this has been a pretty significant controversy, though. Especially in different parts of the valley. I mean, I know in the Scottsdale area, there was a lot of controversy mm-hmm. about a former hotel kind of being turned into a homeless shelter. I think it's reflective of just the problem of homelessness in this community and people trying to get a handle on that. And I totally understand the idea that if I go to a hotel, I want to have a sense of, like, is it a hotel or is it kind of a hotel and half homeless shelter? Like, what is it? So I think that there's an argument to be made just in terms of transparency.
Yeah, Matt, I'm curious about that. Like, if you are a guest at a hotel, like, should you know that there are, like, what the hotel it might also be being used for?
Yeah, sure. I can understand the transparency thing to a degree. I don't think that's what people are actively wondering about when they walk into hotels. I think that's kind of a made-up scenario. I do think that, you know, the folks that came up with this bill, again, it's treating poorly, I would add, a symptom of a broader problem. What does this bill do to actually solve the affordable housing crisis in Arizona? What does it actually do to solve homelessness? And I think the governor and I think a lot of lawmakers, honestly, you know, across the aisle, are much more focused on a macro solution to this instead of, you know, some quick obscure wins. So I'm not surprised she vetoed it.
At the same time, though, we've not really seen a ton of action this year on housing type bills. I mean, there's another so-called Starter Homes Act, which the governor vetoed one last year. It seems like this year's version is not going anywhere. Like, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of action on what you're talking
about. Well, I'll be careful because I am working with some clients on some of the defending against some of the housing legislation that's in there. Mm-hmm. But I will say it's been a defensive year from a standpoint of making sure bad housing bills don't get through.
Matt Benson, do you think this is sort of symptomatic of sort of one aspect of a bigger problem in the sense that the state does not have enough housing, does not have enough affordable housing, and it doesn't seem as though a whole lot at the state level is getting done about it?
Well, it's a huge issue, and it's very difficult, in my estimation, for government to really have an effect on something that is macroeconomic. I think you're going to start to see the price of housing come down as the glut of new houses come onto the market, and we're seeing that happen in real time. So that is going to change some of the housing issues. And really, I mean, if you're talking about homelessness, I feel like we too often forget the mental illness and substance abuse side of that problem. So this isn't purely, it's not, the homeless population isn't comprised of just people who got priced out of a home.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I guess that raises the question, and this sort of goes back to what we talked about with the budget. Given a lot of the fiscal uncertainty, does it seem as though the state might have money to try to deal with some of those things, to try to help folks who have substance abuse issues or serious mental illness, or even the folks who just sort of got priced out of the housing market? Are there going to be resources to help folks who need it this year?
Not enough.
Not enough. Matt Grotsky, what do you think?
I was just laughing. All the more reason to pass a budget, right? Like, who knows? You know, I think that's one of the other things is make sure that they've got resources to deal with this. And I think until the legislature comes back and we can have serious conversations about these issues, it's going to be status quo, and that's not good for anybody.
I mean, California has spent billions upon billions of dollars addressing its homeless crisis and throwing new homes at it and trying to get, you know, people into housing, and it has been an epic failure.
Again, the one of the broader issues is you build all these things, whether it's small houses or, you know, single-family houses, mm-hmm. but if you're allowing large developers or investors to buy them up and then surcharge, right, that's not solving the affordability component. So there's, you got to look at this from a bigger standpoint than some of these other pieces of legislation.
Well, and that's been one of the big issues, Matt Benson, that we've seen in a lot of the housing bills. We saw it in the Casita bill. We've seen it with the various iterations of the starter homes bills about whether or not there are provisions in there to preclude either investors from buying these or building these, or from people renting them out as Airbnbs or VRBOs, things like that. If it's really going to be housing versus like an investment or a vacation place.
Well, I'm sorry. That's a complete red herring. The investor argument that Democrats in particular like to make is a red herring. And I don't buy it one iota.
So do either of you think that in whenever the legislature comes back, and there will obviously be like a big pile of things for them to do, presumably somewhat quickly, given that they have to wrap up the budget by the end of June and try to get out usually around that time. Do either of you think some version of a Starter Homes Act will be on the docket, Mr. Grotsky?
I'm feeling no. Just the vibes I'm getting over the last few weeks, I don't think that it's going to make it through.
Mr. Benson?
Yeah, there's too much opposition and it's. The opposition is kind of bipartisan in nature.
Mm. All right, fair enough. Matthew Benson, Matt Grotsky, the Mats in the studio. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why two folk musicians snuck poster board signs and a banner on stage for their performance at the Kennedy Center. But first, the Phoenix Mercury tip off the 2025 season tomorrow night at home against the Seattle Storm. And when they do, they'll take the court without two of the franchise's mainstays, Diana Taurasi, who retired after last season, and Brittany Griner, who signed as a free agent with Atlanta. With me for a preview of the Mercury's upcoming season is Ben Pickman, a staff writer for The Athletic covering women's basketball. And Ben, it seems as though this is the end of an era for the Mercury and the beginning of a new one. Do you get the sense that's how the organization is seeing it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is definitely the way to put it. And whether the organization, how often they want to say it or not, that is undoubtedly the truth, right? You mentioned it. Diana Taurasi has finally retired after two decades in the WNBA. And Brittany Griner, a fellow former number one pick of the organization, has gone on to the Atlanta Dream. And so if you go up and down this Phoenix Mercury roster, there are a lot of names that fans of the team are not going to recognize. I mean, Kali Acapa really is the big headliner who they acquired before last season, who is now on the team this year. But a lot of the roster, especially this new core, has been overhauled. And so, yeah, it is certainly the turning of the page from what the team is going to look like in the 2025 season.
And safe to say that they are really sort of relying on a big three to try to lead them here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have seen this around the league, some concentration of, you know, duos and trios, but Phoenix is especially stark because, you know, while they have three players who all could make all WNBA first team or all WNBA second team, the rest of the roster really is full of inexperienced players. I mean, Sammy Whitcomb, you know, she is a guard who comes from the Seattle Storm. She's going to play a big role on the team. She's been in the league for 8 years. She'll play a big role. But, like, in terms of your fourth starter on a roster, you know, she's just a classic role player in the WNBA. And so really it is a top-heavy roster, one of, if not the most top-heavy rosters in the whole league, with Copper, Alyssa Thomas, and Satu Savali.
And one of the things that a lot of folks are talking about is this idea of positionless basketball, because both Thomas, Savali, and Copper all kind of play the same position, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, they play different positions in that Kalia Copper is more of a wing, and Satu Savali is 6'4", whereas, again, Copper is 6'1". The positionless factor, a lot of it goes to Alyssa Thomas, who played a lot of point guard, frankly, despite being a power forward or traditional power forward size at 6'2", throughout her career with the Connecticut Sun. But also, it's out of necessity, because if you, again, look at the Phoenix Mercury roster depth, like, Thomas has shown that she can create and she can bring the ball up the floor and initiate offense. And so it makes a lot of sense that with this roster that is thin and relatively inexperienced in terms of depth, like, you want the ball in your hands of your best players as much as possible. And so Thomas has shown she can initiate offense. And so it makes sense that, you know, your 6'2 forward is going to have the ball in her hand a lot creating offense. And the same is true with Savali, who at 6'4 can also handle the ball.
So listening to you describe the Mercury roster, I'm struck, especially with the idea of a big three and sort of a top-heavy roster. It doesn't sound that dissimilar to the way a lot of folks were describing the Phoenix Suns roster this past year. And as we all know, that didn't work out that well. Is there a chance that it might work out better for the Mercury?
I think there is a chance, but I think the comparison is certainly a fair one to make. And it's certainly a question, you know, that I have of, what happens if one of these three players does go down with an injury for an extended period of time? Of course, you never wish that upon a player, but it's just a potential reality of the situation. You know, an injury to Savali, Thomas, or Copper really could be especially detrimental to, you know, the Phoenix Mercury in their desires to compete and be among the WNBA's best this year.
So where do prognosticators think the Mercury will be this year? I mean, does this look like have the feel of a playoff team?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still certainly enough talent on this team to be a playoff team. And there's a chance if the new big three of Copper, Thomas, and Savali gels the way, you know, people in Phoenix suspect or want, they could be in the top four if everything really, really, really does go their way. But it's a really interesting franchise, too, because we have seen the Phoenix Mercury invest, and they have this new beautiful practice facility, which opened last year around All-Star break. They're well-positioned, I would say, no matter how they perform this year on court, to still be an attractive place for prospective free agents to play in the future, because, again, they have an ownership group that has shown that they will invest in the franchise. They have been aggressive making trades, and they have this beautiful facility that, you know, has tons of amenities that any player would want. And so it's still a desirable place to play in the future, even if this season does not go the way that fans might hope.
It's interesting, though, because it seems as though a lot could change in the not-too-distant future in the WNBA with the collective bargaining agreement ending.
Yeah, I mean, there's a new CBA, a new collective bargaining agreement that is currently being negotiated, and it sets to, you know, be a transformative document in the league going forward. I mean, salaries, among other priorities, are very it's widespread. There's widespread belief that salaries are going to increase substantially. So that's going to be one significant change. But one other thing to be aware of is that pretty much all of the veteran players in the WNBA are free agents after this season. They'll all hit the open market and have the opportunity to sign with different teams. That includes, you know, the Phoenix Mercury's trio that we've talked about. And so what that does is teams are trying to kind of position themselves not only as great on-court products and show off their cultures and foundations right now, but, you know, they're trying to show that they have great facilities, that they have great ownership investment. They're trying to position themselves, really jockey for position, to attract some of these big free agents. And so, you know, next winter, sets up to be one of the craziest ever, not the craziest in league history.
Interesting. So last year, the WNBA saw tremendous growth, a lot more higher TV ratings, a lot of ticket sales, and a lot of folks were attributing that to the Caitlin Clark effect. How does the league try to maintain that momentum?
Well, the short answer is that they've put Caitlin Clark and the Indiana Fever on national television in 41 of Indiana's 44 games. That is the most of any team in the league. And so if you want to keep the Clark mania and Clark effect high and the ratings, you know, as high as they possibly can be, they've made the decision to put the Indiana Fever on as pretty much as they can. So that's kind of the starting point. And then if you go down the line, I mean, the Aces and the Liberty are on national television a lot. Like, you know, they're certainly going to, they're promoting the stars that they know are draws. And we shall see. There's a lot of really, really talented teams in the league this year. And, you know, again, those TV decisions help paint a picture of what the league thinks and where they're directing eyeballs to.
Sure. All right. That is Ben Pickman, covers women's basketball at The Athletic. Ben, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. A folk music duo plays the Musical Instrument Museum tomorrow night. Earlier this year, they found themselves with a difficult creative decision to make. My co-host Sam Dingman has the story.
Back in February, President Trump was made chairman of the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. He announced he'd be taking control of programming at the venue and that there would be changes. For too long, he said, Kennedy Center shows have been, quote, woke. In response, a wave of influential artists canceled their scheduled performances at the Kennedy Center, including Issa Rae, Rhiannon Giddens, and Lin-Manuel Miranda. But some artists who disagree with Trump are taking a different approach.
Morally, it was the right thing to do to cancel, you know, like it felt very comfortable, very secure.
Nora Brown is a banjo and guitar player. She tours nationally with fiddle player Stephanie Coleman, performing old-time bluegrass and American folk music. Both Brown and Coleman disapprove of the president's policies, and they too had a show scheduled at the Kennedy Center. But something about canceling it felt too easy.
When I go to a protest or when I have some sort of strategic disobedience that I'm participating in, mm-hmm. there should be some sort of feeling of nervousness and excitement, and like there's a sort of fear, like that you're breaking some rules or something. And I think that like the idea of canceling didn't really give me that feeling.
On Instagram, Brown and Coleman wrote, quote, "We believe the most effective form of protest for us will be expressing disapproval loudly inside the institution where the voices of artists are actively being silenced." So, before their performance, they made two big poster board signs and a banner, and they smuggled them into the show. Or at least that's what they thought they were doing.
We came into the Kennedy Center, like, hiding the banners. Like, we were, like, behind our instrument cases. We were, like, so nervous.
Yeah, the posters were so big. They're 5 feet tall. And they were those, like, science exhibit posters uh-huh. that are, like, trifold. Yeah. They fold in.
Right.
And we're, like, sneaking them in onto the stage and, like, thinking the stage manager didn't see what we were doing, you know? And we just, like, they totally saw that we were doing that.
When the show began, Brown and Coleman set up the signs on either side of the stage. One said, "Reinstate queer programming," and the other said, "Creativity at the Kennedy Center must not be suppressed." Then they played for about an hour, and before their last number, Brown addressed the audience.
This is a song that I picked up from our friends, the Foghorn String Band. It's called Reap What You Sow, and I think it would be a good sing-along if people are... Is anybody... Want to sing a little bit? Okay, cool.
As a group of audience members jumped on stage, Brown made one more request.
We have a banner here that if you want to help us hold it while we sing, we'd appreciate that.
The audience members unfurled the banner, which read, "Art will not submit to your authority, Trump." Once everyone was in position, Brown and Coleman started singing a song called "Sow 'Em on the Mountain."
You're gonna reap just what you sow. Sow 'em on the mountain, reap 'em in the valley. Sow 'em on the mountain, reap 'em in the valley. Sow 'em on the mountain, reap 'em in the valley. You're gonna reap just what you sow.
Little by little, the crowd started clapping, and on the last chorus, everybody on stage and plenty of people in the crowd sang along.
Reap 'em in the valley, sow 'em on the mountain. Reap 'em in the valley, sow 'em on the mountain. just what you sow.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all so much. Thank you, everyone. Hope you have a great night. Thank you for coming up on stage, and thanks for singing.
Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman will be performing at the Musical Instrument Museum tomorrow night.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. Don't forget, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's called Radioheads at tinyurl.com/theshowradioheads. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shouts, our digital editor, Chad Snow, the news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman, I am Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.